record. Hello. That looks like it's... Good evening. I think this is recording. We like to put these... Last time it didn't work, which is why I'm a little bit anxious about it. My name is David Kramer. I'm director of the library here at JTS. And it is our pleasure to sponsor these book talks, series of book talks each year. We make it our business to find distinguished books of Jewish interest. Tonight that has a slightly different meaning than it normally does, since in all honesty this began as a way for us to offer cultural events at JTS with no budget. So, you know, we do offer to faculty members, you're publishing a book, let's do a book talk. And so, of course, what that means is that overwhelmingly the books that we've featured have been books of academic interest, books of Jewish scholarship, history, and the like. Well, it's fair to say that this is tonight's book is very different. It's got a great many insights and interesting things to offer, the details of which I will leave to the author and her colleague here to explore in greater detail. I will only say, you know, as a last word of introduction, that it's really a pleasure to have you. Amy was around these parts, as many of you know, for a good many years as director of publications for the RA. Little did we know during all of that time, maybe you do, I don't, you know, the full extent of her imagination, which comes to expression in this book. I mean, to distill it into one simple observation, it's fair to say that most of the books that we feature will be, you know, deeper on the scholarship perhaps, but not nearly as much fun to read. You know, unlike this one, which is an enormous joy to read, and, you know, you'll hear more about that right now. So I introduce the author. And, I mean, you know about the details of the program since you saw the advertisement. Welcome.
Thank you, David. Thank you all for coming. This is a kind of homecoming for this book tonight. I worked in this wonderful building for 14 years. I came on board as a writer and a mother needing a day job. But working as director of publications for the RA is much more than a day job. It completely captured my heart and my imagination. I was often regaled with anecdotes about JTS history. I was invited into many discussions about how to bridge the gap between rabbis and congregants through books. And I edited works that spoke to my own religious and intellectual sensibilities. This gave me an extraordinary creative platform, and this book represents its fulfillment. Tonight is in so many ways a homecoming, and I just feel honored to see this book in this building. It's just really very exciting for me. So this book began with a simple and frankly very Jewish question, which is, how is a collective story passed down after tragedy and trauma? And my question led me to three characters caught between worlds. Walter Westhaus is a spiritual nomad, a German Jew who fled Nazi Germany and spent the war years in India at the ashram of the Bengali Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore. Rosalie Karam is the daughter of an iconoclastic Hasid. Her father is sort of a combination of Zalman Schachter Shalomi and my late grandfather. And she's a free-spirited Rebbetzin trapped between tradition and a kind of feminist longing. Sal Karam is a conservative rabbi whose crisis of faith reveals the boundaries and possibilities of his spiritual identity. These characters gave me a venue where I could ask my own burning questions, like, what does it mean to love Jewish texts and deeply care about these ancient words? What are the boundaries of faith and of marriage? And perhaps most personally, what does it mean to be a spiritual nomad and yet a member of a tribe? And what does it mean to tell a story in the first place? So to set our conversation in motion, I'd like to give you a sense of the narrative flow of the first section of the novel. In 1946, Walter Westhaus, a traumatized German Jewish refugee arrives at JTS right here, wearing an Indian tunic, sniffing exotic spices, and quoting Tagore's poetry. He meets Sal Karam, a promising rabbinical student. A brilliant non-believer, Walter is the perfect foil for Sal's spiritual questions and an alluring paramour for Sal's fiancée, Rosalie. Months later, the three of them shatter their bond, retreating to opposite sides of the country, Walter to pursue an academic career as a historian of religions in Berkeley, and Sal and Rosalie to lead a congregation in suburban New York and start a family. A chance meeting in Jerusalem in 1967 reconnects them, and their lives become braided together in a tangle of conflicted desire and faith. Before Shuli and I start talking, I'll read three brief excerpts from the chapter that takes place at JTS in 1946, when Walter first arrives, accompanied by his mentor, Paul Richardson. Paul Richardson and Walter Westhouse arrive at the seminary during a late November snowfall. Walter wears his green kurta pajamas from the ashram, with Paul's tweed jacket draped over his shoulders for warmth. His cloth shoes are caked with snow. As they enter the seminar room, a rabbi hands each man a black satin yarmulke. The rabbinical students slouch around a table, their arms crossed over their narrow ties. Paul talks about his research in India and how one spiritual tradition is porous to another. We are all connected in the unending chain of belief and doubt. Together, we can answer each other's questions. Sal wrinkles his nose and turns to his friend Morris. Welcome to the seminary clown show. Or a new class in practical rabbinics. Who's the sidekick? Asks Sal. A German Jew by way of India, says Morris, testing our tolerance for guilt. Your final exam, gentlemen. In this corner, we place a guru, and in this corner, a Jewish survivor. How will your teachings hold up now? Sal stares at Walter. The man with high cheekbones has come dressed for a Purim party. He hopes someone will bury the yarmulke that covers his long brown stringy hair. Surely he picked up microbes on the streets of Bombay. To Sal, Walter doesn't seem like a Jewish refugee at all, but like a character who stepped out of a storybook he read as a boy. Sal shuts his eyes and wonders if this man is a figment of his imagination, but when he opens them, Walter is smiling. Morris turns to Sal. The refugee likes you, he whispers. Sal gazes down at the table as Paul explains the myth of the eternal return. Everything cycles back to its cosmic origins, he says. Even the Bible considers this, yet so much is imperceptible to us. We misread so many cues. How about a line of poetry, Walter? We cross infinity with every step. We meet eternity in every second. Walter looks up and smiles. Rabindranath Tagore. Morris turns to Sal. What the hell is that supposed to mean? And who is Rabbi Tagore? I'm guessing Hasidic, says Sal. The seminary rabbis stand in the back of the room and cast awkward glances at one another. After he finishes remarks, Paul announces that Walter will be joining the rabbinical students for the remainder of the academic year. Teach my students Hebrew and Bible. Show him how to wander through a text and uncover meaning. One day you will be proud to have known him. Invariably and inevitably, Walter and Sal become chavruses, and soon after, Rosalie and Walter form their own bond, a very different kind of chavrusa relationship. In this excerpt, Walter brings Sal to the attic where he sleeps. The seminary attic is cluttered with books and papers waiting for burial, faded prayer books with missing pages, a volume of Talmud munched on by bugs, discarded source sheets, solicitation letters inscribed with biblical verses that were never mailed. Prayer shawls are strewn about, some with holes, some never worn. Just like in the dorm rooms, mice scurry everywhere. In a corner, a Torah scroll lies on a low table, properly covered with a suit jacket that Walter borrows when one of the rabbis scolds him for improper dress. The attic has become Walter's sleeping loft. He has named it the Geniza, a holding place for cast-off sacred books, which he has begun to sort and shelve into an organized library. After he invites Saul for a tour. After class, he invites Saul for a tour. It's the place, says Walter, where the dead visit on Mondays and Thursdays to read Torah, enlighten me, and then return to the world to come. The floor is littered with books, and Saul is reluctant to step on them. I can't walk on a prayer book, he says. I'll look from here. Walter takes Saul's hand. Trust me, he says. I won't let you tread all over your holy words. I'll keep my rabbi fit for his profession. And now I'll read the scene when Rosalie meets Walter in the Geniza for the first time, which will give you a window into Rosalie's character at this point. Walter is sitting at the top of the stair. Walter is waiting for her, his head balanced in his hands, his elbows resting on his knees. She sits beside him and can smell the spices on his breath. After a few moments, he takes her hand, opens the door to the attic, and begins his tour. She pauses at the section of Hasidic books and pulls out a volume. Ah, the Ishbitzer, she says. The Meha Shaloach. My father taught me this. She reads, when a man yearns for something, he should see that the object of his desire is the will of God. What if the man has no God? Let desire be your God, says Rosalie. That works for me, says Walter. Rosalie points out the letters crowding the page. This is easier than learning Talmud. Walter takes the book from her hands and turns it upside down. When he shakes the pages, a single sprig of faded freesia drops onto the floor. He picks it up, sniffs, and carefully tucks it behind her ear. She runs her fingers along the spines of the books, and Walter's long fingers follow hers. I can teach you how to understand these books, she says. My Hebrew is miserable, says Walter. I can play games with the text, but I make up the meanings. Rosalie laughs. That's half of it. These rabbis were playing games, too. They were creating a new art form. She pulls out a random book and points to a word. Look, here's the shoresh, the root, and then you have a starting place, the seed of the concept. You should be a rabbi, says Walter. Ha! The daughter of a rabbi marries a rabbi. That's how it goes. A link in the chain. You can be my rabbi, says Walter.
So I think maybe I'm sitting here in this spot to engage with you, Amy, on this book, because I am one of those daughters of a rabbi who married a rabbi. And in fact, my father was a student at around the time that you are describing here at JTS, and my parents' romance blossomed in this institution as well, although I never heard any Geniza stories. So, the obvious question to me is, why did you place your book, this sort of story of intimacy and connection, why is its foundation JTS?
So, first of all, this place holds a lot of magic. When I was working here, it was in the late 90s. And there were still professors walking around who were talking about Abraham Joshua Heschel and sharing anecdotes and reciting Heschel's poetry to me. And there was a lot of magic in the air and a lot of learning just in all kinds of random ways in the hallways. So I always felt this was a very magical and very charged place. So it became a natural setting for this story. And the other thing is that I deliberately wanted to write a novel about Jews who cared about text. And I wanted their love for text to be as passionate as their love for another person. And in some ways, I was responding to all of the Jewish fiction where Jews are loving other things, but not necessarily really caring about ancient text. And I wanted that to be part of the story. Mm. And that became the natural setting.
That's great. As a historian, I, of course, am in awe of this because I hide behind my footnotes and I've certainly never even attempted a novel. I'm fascinated by the way in which you, in novelistic form, really capture the ethos of post-war American Jewish suburban life through the rabbinic career of Saul and Rosalie. But I'm also a little sensitive, since, as I've outed myself, my dad was, I think, a pretty successful conservative rabbi, not far from where you grew up. We grew up maybe 15 minutes from each other, we discovered. It feels like, in many ways, you are... you're sending a message of a pretty, I think, scathing critique of JTS and the rabbis that it trained, who, through the person of Saul, you describe as being ill-prepared to meet the needs of post-war American Jews. So I'm just going right for the jugular.
Going right for it, right.
You knew that I would, right?
Right, and this was a setup because my response is ready. Okay.
I did tip her off because I thought that would be a little harsh.
Right. And my response is the novelist card, right?
Mm-hmm.
No footnotes, no filter. Everything came from Saul's character. And yet, at the same time, the synagogue that I portray is in many ways a portrayal of the synagogue in which I grew up. Very different from the successful synagogue you grew up in.
Should have moved to Atlanta.
You know, I was on the other side of town where, you know, it was always fledgling. And it was always kind of tender and sweet. And it never was successful in a certain way. And yet that became the place, the foundational place of my synagogue education, right? So it was still a very magical environment in many ways, and yet there was tremendous dissonance. You know, it was the Hebrew school you don't go to. It was the rabbi that you don't quite respect because he's not sure why he's there. It's the parents who have dissonance about anybody who seems too religious. You know, there was an expression I grew up with, holier than thou, right? At the same time, there was also a very deep investment in the synagogue. So there was a lot of ambivalence, and I think it gave me great material as a writer and ultimately as a thinking Jew that I grew up to be, because there was a lot of openness about talking about doubt, and things that didn't quite feel natural, things that, real feelings of dissonance that I think are part of any religious community. But Saul is, I mean, for those of you who haven't read the book, Saul has a really hard time as a congregational rabbi. His sermons are too scholarly, they're too off-putting, he doesn't understand the congregants, he doesn't know how to make a connection. The job is not a natural fit for him. And part of that is that Saul's personality. That's part of what makes him, frankly, such a fascinating character. So, again, it was not meant as a critique.
Fascinating? Okay. I'm going to save you from this, because you totally redeem yourself, and I'd love for you to read a passage which really I found extraordinarily moving towards the end of the book, also towards the end of Saul's life, some page 254, where you really, you very much capture the sort of profound impact that a rabbi, even a rabbi who may be less than successful as a preacher, can have on a congregant even without knowing it.
So at this point in the story, Saul is, he's dying, and he's talking to Rosalie about his life and his profession. I lived with shame, Rosalie, so much shame, working a job that asked me to turn myself inside out, reveal my soul, explain my passion, all in the service of the tribe. And the clapping, the cheerleading, trying to make people sing when they didn't feel like singing. Feel the love, feel the love. What an awful burden. Better to be a spiritual civilian than a spiritual leader. Rosalie smiles. Did I tell you that Bev called? I can't recall a Bev. Hat? Doily? Frizzy hair, flip-flops. I remember now. She told me to thank you. You're welcome, whatever. No, Sol, for something you did many years ago. After Bev got up from sitting shiver for her father, you stopped by her house and offered to drive her to the supermarket. And then you took her to the Cosmos Diner and bought her a place of scrambled eggs. So? You sat across from her in a booth, and she told you stories about her father's tailor shop, how she would draw pictures on the backs of yardsticks and eat pastrami sandwiches while his customers came in for a fitting. And you listened to every little story about her father and his customers all afternoon until the sun began to set. Not such a big deal, but it was.
Indeed. Beautiful. So I guess I'd like to focus a little more on Rosalie. You hint at her suitability for that Rebbetzin role. She marries Sol deliberately because she wants that kind of life. As most of you know, I wrote a more scholarly book on that particular topic of the rabbi's wife. So I really thought that you really beautifully captured the sense of kind of the derivative nature of that role of being tied to the rabbi. She's worried that he's going to fail as a rabbi, and then where the heck is she going to be? She's not going to have a place to live. She's not going to have purpose in life. You get the sense right at the beginning of the book that maybe she would have been a better rabbi than her husband. But, you know, in the 1950s, that obviously was not an option for her. Yes, she married what she wanted to be, which she already understood was what she was supposed to do, and which so many women who were at JTS did at the time. But I think that you also really capture the ambivalence that she had throughout her life about that role. When she was with her congregants, she couldn't wait to get away from them. When she was away from them, she worried about them. And so I hope you read a passage that that is my favorite passage
in
the book.
This is Julie's favorite passage. even more than the Bev passage.
Yep. 160.
Thank you. Okay, so at this point, Rosalie is with Walter. It's one of their rendezvous. When she is alone with Walter, she feels as if she has departed this world and inhabits a distant planet. She misses the antics of her sons, and the synagogue seems like a forgotten dream. When she lies in his arms, she often thinks about the congregants, these intimate strangers who make her feel tethered to something outside of her own confusion, and she relaxes. She likes to ponder their delicate geometry of faith and consider what they truly need. Serena needs a little astonishment that speaks to the body, something that will bite her behind the knees when she least expects it. Nadine needs to know that the politician she loves will find another woman and she will survive the loss. Delia needs a prayer of healing that she can repeat like a mantra during chemotherapy. Marv needs to marry his son's teacher. And Missy Samuels needs to wear less makeup and quit her job as a Weight Watchers group leader. Rosalie knows more about these people than Sol ever could. When Delia began chemo, Rosalie delivered casseroles to her house. When Bev's father collapsed for the last time, Sol sent Rosalie to accompany Bev to the hospital so she wouldn't be alone when he died. When Serena sat shiva for her mother, Rosalie delivered the cold cuts and searched Serena's kitchen drawers for the meat silverware, the saran wrap, and the garbage bags. Nowhere a woman stores her jello molds, thinks Rosalie, and you will understand the contours of her heart.
We can't talk about the 50s without jelly molds.
Absolutely, I know.
So you write with such empathy for Rosalie. So I have to ask, why didn't you become a rabbi?
So if I had become a rabbi, I never could have written this book, that's for sure. And I have a somewhat nomadic imagination, and that always, I mean, I was never drawn to the rabbinate as a way to make a living for myself, ever. But I love learning, and I loved hanging out here a lot, and obviously I think about this a lot, or at least did for this book. I can't say I'll do it for the next book. But my imagination needed to be free to go around everybody's story. And I think if you work as a rabbi, there are other constraints on your imagination. I think it's complicated. Mm-hmm. And I know there are rabbis who are novelists, and that would actually be a really interesting conversation mm-hmm. to have.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. My father always used to say that the longer he was in the congregation, the less he could say on Rosh Hashanah, because if he looked out there and he knew the personal stories of every single person sitting there in the kahal, how could he even think that he could say anything that would be, that would not cause someone pain? Yeah, that's true. So I guess I'm not as careful a reader as I like to think that I am, because it wasn't until the end of the book when I read Maya's piece at the end that I then went back to the beginning of the book, and I'm like, and then I, of course, realized that the entire book is framed through Maya's eyes. So why that framing for the book?
So Maya is Saul and Rosalie's daughter. I'll say that very simply now, because some of you have not read the book. And what you find out when you look at the prologue, you realize there is a narrative voice here. It's first person, and then it goes into third person. The first person comes back at the end, and then you realize she wrote this book. And once I knew that, I had this book, because I wanted this to be a book about storytelling and reinterpretation and how to interpret a previous generation and the dissonance and the uncertainty involved in telling any story, because we really can't know anybody's life, really. And Shuli and I were talking about this the other day. You said, mm-hmm. well, you can look at the cookbooks and then you can know for sure what they really baked. Mm-hmm. But we don't really know what was in their hearts. And I wanted to play with that question and put that at the center of the book, and also related to the whole notion of faith in the first place. The idea of faith and belief in a sort of religious, spiritual context, and also the faith of the imagination and the faith involved in storytelling. And I wanted those two motifs to work together throughout the book. And Maya is a conflicted narrator, because she herself becomes a rabbi, a kind of renewal rabbi, and she's caught between wanting to make meaning, because that's what she naturally does, and also respecting dissonance and uncertainty and doubt. And you can then, at the end, go back and read the whole book in a whole other way, and you can find her conflict in the way she uses different motifs of narrative.
So I have other questions, but probably a lot of other people here have questions too. So I'm happy to open it up. And I know Amy would be delighted to answer your questions.
Hi, Hanan.
Did you have to do any historical research to write the book, or was it more based out of your own experiences, growing up and working here and so forth?
I had to research the India part. The way I found out about, the way I I got Walter to this ashram of this Indian poet was because many years ago I had read about Jews who fled Nazi Germany and actually found their way to India and were embraced by the Indian community. Not a whole lot. And I found this wonderful book. And at that point, I just wanted to find out about the boat Walter might have been on to get him to India. But then I flipped ahead a few more chapters, and there's this amazing story of this German Jew named Alex Aronson, who actually spent time at Tagore's ashram. And once I had that, then I was invited to work with Tagore's poetry. Then, this is what makes writing fiction so much fun, I found all these parallels between Tagore's poetry and some of Heschel's work. And it was just like a feast. I really had a great time. So a little bit of research really paid off. And that was really most of what I needed to research. There was a little bit of fact-checking here and there. I needed to work really hard to keep track of dates because I was working with 70 years and a lot of life and death. And I was constantly making spreadsheets. And I'm not very good at math.
Can you comment on the title?
Yes. So the title came about, frankly, because the original title for many years was The Mountain of Spices. This book has a lot of Midrashic Song of Songs motifs, and The Mountain of Spices, you know, it's from the last verse, and it worked with all of these motifs. And my agent in Jerusalem said, title's not strong enough. I said, it's from the Song of Songs. Like, how could it not be strong enough? She said, find something else. And I'm also a poet, so I sat down with the manuscript at that point, and I just combed through every word, and I started moving words around and seeing what fit and what worked. Mm-hmm. And then when this worked, it encapsulated so much of what the book is about on so many levels. And so that's how
what
happened.
Can
I explain it?
It's self-explanatory to you.
It's self-explanatory to me, right. So you can understand, I mean, it's a poetic, it's really a little poem, right? So the beautiful possible is what is... what does it mean to make the beautiful possible? So in an early scene in the book, which I won't go into, when Sonia is with his fiance, she says, let's go to Palestine, let's get out of here, we will make the beautiful possible. So there's a little bit of punning going on. And then later, when Rosalie is falling in love with Walter, she's saying, this is beautiful possible wrong, it's wrong beautiful possible, it's this braid of our three lives together, and it's a braid of words. So I was able to play around with that. And then there's a whole other notion of the beautiful possible, which is almost this Hasidic idea of life moving on to another iteration, the next story, the continuing unfolding.
Thank you.
Would you like to comment, since JTS trained people do the right thing and righteousness and so forth, and transgression is the opposite of that. Would you like to comment on how transgression and sanctity are linked, both in your vision and also in the Jewish tradition?
Wow, okay.
So the second half back to him.
Yeah, I know. I'll find a way to do that. So I had a text to help me out here, right? So I was studying Hasidut at Drisha, and I was introduced to the Ishbitzer. And, you know, the Ishbitzer, I mean, I'm going to be a little reductionist here, but the Ishbitzer basically said, you know, everything is under the province of God, even the things that you're not supposed to do. And he, of course, meant it as my very dati teacher, Adrisha said, as once you're already aligned with halakha, you can understand the text in a new way from this interpretation. But this was also considered a very renegade book because you could take it as, it's all good. You know, it's all good. It all belongs to God. You know, like just, you know, free love, you know, and it's all part of the sacred story. And I think there's some, obviously, some tension in that. We see some of these motifs in contemporary Jewish life, in renewal, in our own, I mean, I see it in everybody I know, right? But those are the people I hang out with, which might not be the people you hang out with. So that's where that comes from. And I also wanted to play with notions of right and wrong to tell a larger story. So in the Bible, there's a lot of stuff that happens that's not supposed to happen, right? You know, somebody, you know, there's a bond between two people that's not, it's kind of illicit or very illicit. And then kind a generation of. Later, you know, this wonderful, you know, something else happens and the story changes shape. And I think to me that feels like real life. So that's how that all came about, and I definitely wanted to play around with these ideas in my own imagination.
You've done very well.
Thank you. I didn't need Shuli to bail me out.
The book opens November 1938, Germany. There was a scene of brutality there. And I wondered why. You know, that doesn't seem to linger in the narrative. And it's interesting to me. It hasn't come up in any of the discussion here so far. So what's it doing?
So I deliberately didn't want to bring it up, and I haven't been reading from that chapter because, first of all, in many ways it stands alone, and it's not, it ends in such a shocking way, and it's not a redemptive chapter. But here's what it's doing there. And again, I apologize for those of you who haven't read the book yet. In the first chapter, Walter's fiancée, Sonia, is murdered along with Walter's father. And they dream of making a life in Palestine. And then it's just all over. It's just all over. He's got to get out. He goes to Trieste. He goes to India. One thing leads to another and another and another. And he longs for Sonia. And Sonia is in many ways this ghostly presence throughout the book. But obviously, if you read the book, as I don't want to say too much, Sonia comes back. And at the end of the book, Sonia's story continues. So that's the arc from the beginning to the end. And again, I think I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't read the book.
But if I would... Mm-hmm. May add, I think that the Walter's journey, it echoes throughout Walter's life. I mean, he is a damaged soul because of, you know, and so that he can't find a home.
Right.
And that is all a result of that brutal displacement that I think echoes throughout post-war Jewry.
Shira.
I was reading the book today in this coffee shop, sobbing, and trying to keep it from everybody around. But it was all about Maya, and the emotion that you bring out in Maya's love and complicated relationship with her parents and with Walter and with Sonia. How do you, as an artist, capture that degree of profound, complex emotion?
Could you just repeat in a few words the question so that anyone who might be listening to this can...
Sure. So how do I...
How do you capture that emotion that comes through in Maya, in her feelings for her parents and for Walter and Sonia?
Okay, so the question is, how do I... really tell the story and convey Maya's emotions about all these other characters in her life and her own feelings. That happens through writing and rewriting, and for me, working with images and finding the path through the story and the character. It takes a really long time. Maya was not that difficult to write. I think partly because her lineage was so complex and there were so many images and motifs in her psyche that some of them were latent and some of them were obvious. So I understood her, but it took a long time.
How long did you work on this book?
Over 10 years. But who's counting? Sharon.
Maybe this is moving things forward, but I wish you could tell us something about your next project.
I don't know yet. I'm starting to kind of root around, and so I can't really say too much at this point. But it's not this book. I wrote a first novel before this that I put in a drawer a very long time ago. So this is my first finished novel, fulfilled novel. And now I want to be even more ambitious. So that's what I know. Now that I know what the form can lend itself to, I want to go beyond the beautiful possible somehow. But I don't know what that's going to look like. Susan.
In terms of writing the book and the process of writing it, I'm wondering in terms of the craft of it, what were some of the biggest obstacles you encountered in terms of rewriting, you know, the whole process of writing it over the years?
So the question is, what was the process of writing and rewriting over such a long time? What made it very challenging was I was working, and I would often wake up at 4 in the morning to get a hedge on the day so I could have some free time before I needed to move on with my day. And I found myself, I couldn't wait to get back to the book, so I'd find myself going to sleep earlier and earlier so I could wake up earlier and earlier. And then it was like, why am I going to sleep at 9 o'clock? Because I can't wait till it's 4 a.m. again. But that made it very, very challenging because there was a lot of piecemeal. And I did not write this in a sequential way, which made it very, very complicated to edit. My editor is here, and she knows how much work we went through. I almost created this like a Picasso painting. You know, there was a nose here and a leg here, and, you know, things were disjointed, and yet they eventually came together. I ended up rewriting the book at a certain point. I had a couple of friends who said, book's great, send it out. And I had one friend who said, don't shoot yourself in the foot, start all over again. And she was right.
So brave.
Mariana.
Just a question about your process. You were saying that you didn't write this in a linear fashion. And the fact that you were working, while I know you get up at 4 in the morning to write, were you also like stealing moments throughout the day? And how did you manage all of the things that you were writing, which might have happened on different pieces of paper? And I'm making this up, I don't know, but that's how did you orchestrate all of this stuff and get it put together?
Okay, so I have a lot of tote bags. I have many, many tote bags with many scraps of paper and maybe many torn off envelopes. The way it happened is, frankly, this book took over my imagination in such an incredible way that even when I wasn't working on it, I was meditating on it. And I would, every Sunday, I go to my mom's house on Long Island, and it got to the point where I didn't want anybody in the car with me because I needed that time to just talk to myself and go over the sequence of scenes and words and images. And this book was at the edge of every thought for all of those years. And at one point, I felt like, I can't, like, what's going to happen here? Am I ever going to finish it? And I thought, why don't I try making it into a poem? And I actually tried that. I thought, let me just see if I could take this little story, one little scene of Walter, and make one good poem out of it, because it's so hard to write a long narrative. And of course that didn't work. And I was stuck with it, and the book claimed me, and I had to just keep going.
Glad you did.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi. I love the book.
Thanks.
Could you say more about Rosalie? She seems to me to be, I mean, I'm looking at this perhaps from with feminist eyes. She seems to me to be the most grounded, the strongest, most talented in many ways. I know Walter is brilliant, but he's got other issues. So did feminism impress you, influence the way you were writing? Was it the fact that you're a woman? So you made a woman kind of the most attractive character in some ways. I mean, could you just comment on some of those things?
Sure. So Rosalie is a composite of the women I grew up with. So when I was growing up, my mother's friend, this was in the suburbs in the 60s, and my mother did not work at that time, and neither did most of her friends. And they would come over to our house almost every weeknight, and they would start talking very intimately about their lives and their longings. And on one hand, they were very traditional, and on the other hand, they wanted something else that they could not name. And I would sit with them because that was the place to be. And these women gave me Rosalie because I grew up with their voices and I grew up with their yearnings, their incredible humor, their wisdom about Judaism, and yet their great skepticism at the same time. So those voices were a very big part of my childhood and made me a writer and obviously made me a feminist as well.
Did any one of them have a Walter in her life?
No, but you know, it's funny. I kind of wish. Yeah. So after when I first got the case of books, I took the finished book and I went to my mom's house. And you know, a lot of authors on social media, they take a photo of the book and post it on social media. So I took the book and I posted it in front of my mother's window, right near that kitchen table. And I said something about those women, and I said, and I wrote them a book. And here's the book. And my mother is, thank God, reading the book. And what's great is we talk about the book at the same time we talk about those women. But my mom's memory is a little shady. So the stories are getting more and more colorful. And I'm hearing things I never heard before.
So,
yeah.
So the book's taking me to great places. Lisa.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
So when I'm reading the book, and I'm going to go back, there's a few questions that were raised related to kind of pushing issue. It really feels to me that it's a book and on many levels that raises a lot of questions about women's place in Judaism. And certainly Rosalie's character, she really does that. And she goes off and she does what she wants. So I want to know if you'd be willing to sort of speak about that. Now, in other words, you know, fiction is a great opportunity to show the world what we think and what we think can be better and where we think that things should go. So what would you want somebody to take out of this book? And to me, it really seemed to be sort of challenging, you know, a woman's place in Judaism. So I wonder if you would.
So it's, in many ways, the only way I can answer that is to talk about this book as Maya's story, and Maya's inherited story from her very conflicted mother, who could only go so far, and what Maya ends up doing and how she lives at the end of the book, right? So Maya is a very much a feminist figure. She's a rabbi. She's not marrying. She is finding her own way. So Maya is reinterpreting that next generation, a feminist generation. Some people might say, well, she doesn't go far enough. You know, at the end of the book, and here's a little spoiler, she's reading Torah at Women of the Wall. She's part of Women of the Wall. Some people would say, well, that doesn't go far enough, you know? So I think there's always this notion of an inheritance of different generations of feminism. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. I thought the book goes further, actually, my own, as a reader.
Oh, that it went further than that. So Can you say more about that? That's actually.
You know, I mean, the woman, you know, what the whole thing about women are the wall is really that women are, you know, taking possession of Judaism as an equal. And I felt, you know, like, you know, that Rosalie's character and the fact that she actually goes to the learning environment, you know, that women are sort of kept at a distance, and actually women should be central to it, and that women have a tremendous amount to offer from a spiritual and from a scholarly perspective in Judaism. And I really feel that your book is saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you shouldn't be afraid to say it.
Okay, so thank you. And it so I'll say it. And it is there. And I think, you know, where that gets played out is at one point in the story, Rosalie wants to teach a class on Hasidut. And it's going very well, and she's very proud of her source sheet on the Hidden Light. And it's so great for her, she even says to Walter, "I can't see you. Like, I've got to teach about the Hidden Light. This is really fantastic." And so that's going well, and she has three students. And then a few years later, Saul says to her, "You can't do it. It's the same three students. We're building a congregation. Can't you teach them how to play tennis?" And she says, "Don't you know me anymore?" So there's, you know, Rosalie has this, I mean, she really is knowledgeable. And she also, in her own thought process, she's always wrestling with the wider boundaries of doubt and faith. And that is her story. Penny.
I'm wondering, I'm thinking about the fact that you wrestle with these larger sort of life issues in terms of doubt and faith relationships, and the fact that you wrote it over the course of these 10 years. And over the course of 10 years, one naturally will sort of, you know, shift, evolve in terms of one's own relationships with these struggles, and also with relation to one's sense of belonging or not within the frame of any kind of sort of Jewish tradition, etc. And I'm wondering how that process over the course of the 10 years did your relationship to the story, to the characters, and to the struggles shift over the course of the 10 years? Is that part of what, was that part of the rewriting of it? Did that impact things?
It's a great question. And so I guess to take the question back to you. Yeah.
Repeat the question.
Okay. So because this book took so long to write, did my notions of faith and doubt and belonging change in the course of those 10 years? Is that, I mean, I know that's a summary, it's not,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
is it close enough?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, thank you. This book gave me a way to really play around in the sandbox of what was on my mind. And I had a great time. I mean, these characters just became this place where I could just load them up with all of my own questions and all of my own images and my own journeys. And what was amazing is they were able to carry it. And when I finished the book, what moved me the most was I felt such a debt of gratitude to these characters who are not real, but they enabled me to have this place to articulate so much of what's in my head. So that was great. And did it change me? I mean, that's a complicated question. I mean, I think it's, and one of the things I do say in the book is that, you know, faith is always changing, right? It changes from day to day. So that's the only answer I can give. Jan.
Amy, I'm going to push you harder on the question I'm asking.
I know.
If Rosalie is in fact so knowledgeable, why isn't she better educated? And could her husband not have so easily said to her, "You can't teach that class," if she had a more extensive education?
So Jan asked this question at another event. So I asked it to you on the phone. Right. So now I've got an answer, right? Which is that these women I grew up with, none of them were well educated. They did not go to college. And they were truly brilliant, and they were truly gutsy, and they were truly wise, and they knew what they knew. and it wasn't about being educated.
But were they as knowledgeable as Rosalie?
Well, Rosalie was not formally educated, and she learned from her father.
Right, right. Did these women in that circle learn from their fathers what Rosalie learned from her father?
They could have. I mean, Rosalie's made up, right? But my childhood impression of these women who I listened to all the time was of profound brilliance and wisdom. And part of the way they expressed it was in their wit and their incredible sense of humor and the gossip. I mean,
yeah,
you know, that's, you know, that's a great sign of wisdom, right?
Right. So would Sal have been able to say to Rosalie, you can't teach that, if she had been better educated?
Shuli says yes.
Yes, because it's not only about, it's about Judaism, but it's also about human relationships and what and Rosalie's testing the boundaries of marriage and of their, and seeing how far she can stretch and still maintain this relationship.
Right, but could she have stretched farther if she had more education? Could she have stood up to him and said, you know, I have a master's degree, I'm going to teach what I want?
So here's the thing about
only
the...
if she could have gotten paid for it.
Okay.
But here's the sure. thing about...
Yeah.
But here's the thing about the question is Rosalie is fiction. This is, she's a fictional character, so there are no what-ifs in fiction because everything is a what-if.
Hey, okay, I buy that.
One last question. Yeah.
Yes, one last question. Yes.
How much of an influence for substantive conviction do you fear with the famous Cabalist... Colette that Madame Sylvie's based on.
Oh, okay.
So good influence.
Yeah, so
the question.
Okay, so there's a legendary Jerusalem Kabbalist named Colette Albuquerque Muscat, who is the model for Madame Sylvie in the book. She is the only character, Madame Sylvie is the only character who does come from a real person. And I was free to imagine her because by the time I got interested in Madame Colette, she was already gone. So that gave me free rein, and I checked in with her students and said, is anybody going to really mind if I fictionalize her because she's such a great character? And everybody said, go for it, and I did.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you for an absolutely wonderful conversation. There are copies of the book for sale. I fear, though, with the questions, the indication is most of these people already have copies of the book and have read them very carefully.
Well, they're going to buy it as gifts.
Oh, they're going to buy it as gifts. Okay, so the book is available for sale. The author is happy to sign. And how much of the book's going to be?
They're $15.95.
$15.95. Okay, so those are for sale. I just want to thank you for coming. I actually have to make up for an error I committed at the beginning. The error was I had someone approach me not long ago and say, I love listening to the book talks, but you always assume that everybody's in the room, and therefore you don't say what needs to be said for those who are not in the room, for those who are just listening to it. So I should have said at the beginning that, obviously, you all know this, but the book talk is The Beautiful Possible. The author is Amy Gottlieb. Shuli Schwartz, Dean, Dr. Shuli Schwartz was the co-conspirator in this discussion. So I'm sure everyone, to the extent they can hear the conversation on all of its sides, will enjoy this. There are more book talks coming up, including in almost exactly 2 weeks' time by yours truly with my new book. So I invite you to come back for that. And thank you all for coming. Mm-hmm.